3, 2, 1, go!
Welcome back, everybody, to the Triad of the Force podcast, a podcast from Puerto Rican friends coming together to do deep dives into Star Wars and other nerd-related media. This is season 4, and we're very excited to finally conclude our little mini-series about Indiana Jones, because we finally get to talk about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny.
It's interesting, because we've been always calling this a duology, but never thinking that obviously it's going to be a trilogy, because we will eventually have been talking about Dial of Destiny.
Yep. So we are very, very excited to have this conversation. Finally, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen it, do yourselves a favor and go watch it in the theaters, como Dios manda. Trust me, you will not regret it. And joining us again, as he has so far, thank you so much again, Alex Damon from Star Wars Explained, another fan of Indiana Jones. We are so glad to have done this whole series with you. And now we get to talk about the last installment.
Probably finishing it, right? Unless Harrison decides that he's got one more again in him.
How's it going? Say no to that.
We had someone ask, like, what would be your reaction if they announced, we're going to do a 6. I think it would be like an exasperated sigh, just because it's like they keep on being like, this is the last one. Okay, no, this is the last one. No, seriously, this one's the last one.
If they do make a last one, hopefully like Marion and Indy actually, you know, stay together. Stop with the on and off type
stop
of thing.
Stop messing with our hearts.
You're old enough. Let's be mature about this. Stay together for the kids, even though the kids are gone, I guess. Spoiler alert. But yeah, it's been a long time coming. Like, I know I've been very excited for this movie. I know you've been very excited for this movie. Nana, you've been excited. Everyone's been excited for this movie. It's a great summer for blockbusters. Let's be honest, because now we have Barbie coming, we have Oppenheimer. That's gonna be a wonderful day. I just got my Barbenheimer T-shirt, because I'm gonna hopefully do the double feature for those. We got Mission Impossible, so it's gonna be a really fun summer for movies, which might kind of spell some. I don't know how much anyone here cares about box offices, I don't know how you would say that. Whatever. How about the box office of a film? But I don't know how it's looking for Indy. I'm really hoping that this movie, you know, does well at the box office, because I really enjoyed it. And everything I've been seeing so far indicates that we don't know how it's going to do, because it seems that the reviews that came out originally that were kind of sort of trending towards the negative kind of impacted how people, you know, were flocking towards the movie premiere, but it seems like now the reception has been more positive, especially word of mouth, and that has been particularly good, it feels to me, for the movie. So hopefully, you know, it does well, because, you know, we want Lucasfilm to get we want to win on the docket and shut up some of the internet naysayers. But Alex, what did you think? What were your expectations? I know you were tempering them. You had, like, you know, you were responsibly speculating and tempering expectations. But, you know, we can't help but have something when we go into the movies. So, like, what was that experience like for you?
I don't really think I had many expectations. I had hopes. And it was basically just based off of what you and others had said, other people I trust that were fortunate enough to go to the premiere. I had everyone. I was like, tell me what you thought. No spoilers, but just like some basic thoughts. And you said it was your third favorite. And that was kind of what I was hoping for. Mm-hmm. I guess my larger hopes were that it would make me feel as great as Raiders and Crusade do. It did not quite reach that for me. But I do agree that I think it's my third favorite indie movie. So I still had a good time. I was happy and content as I left the theater.
Awesome. Nani, how about you? I know you're sometimes more cynical about these things. So what was your experience with Indy?
I had a lot of fun with it. I'm going to agree with both of you that it's solid, like right there in the middle as the third best one, probably. I was smiling throughout. It was actually better than I was expecting it to be. I never really expected it to beat Raiders or Last Crusade. Mm-hmm. It's because it just, I don't think it can be done when you add all the nostalgia value that you have to it. Like, even if it would have been better, I think it would have been very difficult to beat those two. But I did really enjoy it. It was so much better than Crystal Skull. And I did try to temper my expectations as well. But it was fun. It was a fun film. I went with El Josbando, who isn't actually a big fan of Indiana Jones. And he thinks it's probably been his favorite one. Since he doesn't have like that nostalgia factor attaching the others to them.
Really?
He actually really enjoyed it. Yeah.
I think I like it's that. Important to bring that up. Because I like going and seeing Indiana Jones-esque movies. I was one of the few people that was like, I want to go see the Uncharted movie last year. Yeah. And walked out of that going like, that was better than I expected. Like, I had zero expectations for that. And Molly was pointing out that, like, you know, if we went and saw Uncharted and it was Dial of Destiny, you'd probably be over the moon with how good it was. But because it's an Indiana Jones movie, you're comparing it to two of the greatest films of all time.
That's
and
true.
You just can't help but do that.
Yeah. And I think to that point, I think that's sometimes one of the ways that people are also unfair about reviewing this movie, because I've seen some, and I don't know why I do this to myself, but I torture myself by reading negative reviews sometimes. And some of the negative reviews that I've seen for Dial of Destiny have been very frustrating, because most of them always say kind of the same thing. It's kind of like, well, this would have been a good movie if it hadn't been an Indiana Jones right. movie. And I'm just like, so it's a good movie. So
yeah,
you just said it, like the performances were good. Cinematography was good. The film was good, so just because it's Indiana Jones in the title card, all of a sudden now it's not good. I feel sometimes it's very disingenuous, which I feel it's very frustrating with indie. And some of the things that are happening are also the things that I expected were going to happen, which is people that were hating on Kingdom of the Crystal Skull now are just saying like, oh, see, Kingdom was so much better than Dial of Destiny because it was Lucas and Spielberg, and there's a magic to that. And now it's just mangled. And it's like, okay, well, you weren't saying that 5 years ago. But no, I loved Dial of Destiny. I have full disclosure, I did see it at the premiere, and it was a very impressionable.
Yes,
I was definitely in an environment that was engineered for me to like the movie. So I have full disclosure on that one. Yes, being around, I was sitting next to two guys that were dressed like Indiana Jones. So, you know. That definitely influenced my liking of the film. Yeah. So that's why I wanted to watch it a second time.
How did it feel, when you watched it that second time without all that added influence?
Honestly,
Without the John Williams hype up concert.
Of course, yeah.
The hype up, which I should have seen coming because they always pull that crap. They always hide him somewhere like in the basement or in the attic and then just drop him and everyone's like,
just
whoa!
Falls out of the ceiling.
Yeah.
Surprise.
They always do that and somehow it always catches us off guard. So yes, without Johnny Dubs, as I call him now, because we're friends. Without Johnny Dubs being in the crowd, I actually somehow was more giddy, more happy to see it the second time. Because I think there's something that's better about seeing a movie, especially a movie with this much hype on it, of a fandom that you really like a second time, because your expectations are out the window because you already know what to expect.
You already know what's going
to
happen.
And your guard is down, so you're able to just relax and watch it, as opposed to the first time where you're just like, am I going to like it?
Overanalyzing everything.
Yeah, it's like the final scene in Spaceballs, not Spaceballs, in Fanboys, when they're like watching episode one and all of a sudden they're like, hey, but what if the movie sucks? Right. So like the second time you watch a movie, it's like you don't care about that anymore. So it's just like, okay, let's just enjoy the ride. And second time around, I enjoyed the ride even more because you can, especially knowing the third act plot twist, which it's not really a plot twist, but the third act time travel-y stuff, which we knew there was going to be time travel. But how they did that time travel, I think, was the part that's going to be especially interesting to see how the people react as more people watch the movie. But having, you know, because when I will admit that the first time I saw it, it kind of took me out of it a little bit. I'm like, what are we doing? What's happening? But the second time, it's just like, okay, it was better because then you see the little doll, whatever thing
the marionettes,
you call it.
Yeah.
The marionettes. And you're like, oh, sure, there it is. And then when they're at Archimedes' tomb and it's like the phoenix with the propeller, you're like, oh, crap, this is good setup and good payoff. So I really, 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 really liked it. I did think it was too long. I did think that there was like moments where it started getting a little repetitive, especially with the dial itself. when they're like trying to get it and they got it and they lost it and they got it and they lost it. I was just like, okay, I got it, guys. But I feel like in that sense, like the movie dragged a little bit. It wasn't necessarily bad, but I feel like it's a common trope now with especially Disney movies. I feel like especially with like the live action remakes and everything. It's just like, oh, let's just add 20 minutes to the movie because long movies are cinema.
Yeah, it does seem like just every movie has to be 2.5 hours now. And I'm like, we can go back to just 90 minute movies. That's it's all right.
Good is good. What did you guys feel? Did you feel like the movie dragged? Do you feel like it was perfectly timed? Like, what was your experience in that department? Or was I kind of alone in feeling that the movie was a little too long?
I thought it was long as well, but I also feel like it was well-paced. I don't remember a moment where I was like, bored or not engaged. So I think it was successful there, but I do think 2.5 hours probably didn't have to be that long. And I was rewatching some of the trailers, and I can tell like they did cut some scenes that I was looking forward to seeing, like the boulder from the trailers. Yeah, we didn't get to see that at all. So I know that they made some cuts, they trimmed some fat off the thing, but I think my back more than anything was like, I wish this were a little shorter.
No, I agree that even though it was long, it was paced, I was never bored either. And Wally, actually, Josbando tends to like get bored easily. He's like, I wasn't bored. So that's a good meter there to know. But yeah, I could have used, you know, some of those cars chase scenes, which were super fun, by the way, didn't need to be as extended as they were sometimes, because sometimes they were like pretty long. And then if you would have shortened some and given me a little bit more of like code breaking and, you know, actual grave robbing and finding of the clues, that I missed a little bit. I was expecting to see a little bit more of that. And when it did happen, it made me really happy when it did. But at the end, I was like, wait, I feel like I could have used a little bit more of the digging around for
some. Yeah, yeah, 100%.
But otherwise, it was really fun. And I do remember about halfway through the movie thinking, why aren't they doing the map with the red line? I'm missing it. I'm really upset that they're not doing it. And then literally like 2 seconds after I thought it, they did it. So
right. Happiness. Because the first time he travels after he talks to Sala, I'm like, okay, here we go. We're going to get the map. And then it doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen. Man, this is not, this ain't Casino Royale. You don't break tropes here. You give me those tropes, goddammit. But I like that they saved it for when, because he's not yet Indy there, right? So it's just like, okay, well, we don't get that because he's not Indiana Jones yet. And when he becomes that, when he travels with Helena, is when we get the first map scene. I'm just like, oh, chef's kiss.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. But no, it's I totally forgot what I was about to say. I don't know. I really like this movie. Because I had a point that was really good about what you were saying about something about the pacing. And then I forgot. So let's just move on to like something else. Oh, now I remember. See, if I just ramble, I'll eventually get there. with the whole archaeologing, right? I think that was missing a little bit because I remember when the first clip of the movie came out, and it was the water displacement thing. I lost my goddamn mind because I'm like, that's it. That's exactly what I want from this movie. It's just Indy being Indy, figuring out tombs and unlocking things and history. And history's gonna unlock all this, because that's one of the things that I really, really liked about Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, actually. It's like all those scenes when they're like finally in Peru and he's talking like, oh, we're in Orellana's tomb, and the, you know, the mummy disintegrates. It's like, oh, the body doesn't agree with the air, and like all that stuff. I'm just like, this is done right. That's exactly the type of indie stuff that I want to see. And I feel like Dial of Destiny had like a couple of those things, but I feel like it didn't fully commit to a lot of them, which at this point, like, I don't know if that's good or bad considering like how long the movie already was. So I don't know if it's like you have more extended scenes of that or you cut some. So it's one of those double-edged things. Like, we're talking about the movie being a little too long, but how we want some more of that. It's the Dial of Destiny is based on the, oh my God, I forgot the name. What's the name of the device?
Erikathema.
That thing.
Archimedes dial. Yeah.
Archimedes dial, which I thought was so genius that they based it on that. Because I was just like, that's perfect indie stuff, right? You just take something that's actually based on history and then give it that little extra twist and make it something that's unique to the movie. Alex, what do you think of the dial as the MacGuffin of the movie and how it functioned within the plot?
I really, really like the dial, and I did some very surface level research on it before seeing the movie, and I was impressed with how much of it I was like, yep, that's all true. The where they found it, when they found it, how they found it, the fact that it's made of all these gears and stuff, and it's like technology like this isn't seen anywhere else in history for another like 1,000 years or something. Mm-hmm. And it is just this weird thing that we actually have, and we can't really quite explain it. So to take that and then just go crazy with the fiction of it and be like, what if it wasn't just for predicting the phases of the moon or something, mm-hmm. but it can travel through time, like that's perfect indie for me.
And I have a question about that. I see your opinion, but I'll pin that after. Nani, what do you think of the...
Or you can ask in case you forget.
touche. Yeah. It is Sunday. I might forget. Do you think, because this, I think this is like now, like when we get into like all, you know, the deconstruction of the third act, do you think that the dial itself is magic and thus produce the fissures in time? Or do you think the dial is not magic? It just detects them. It's like a compass, right? It does nothing on its own. Yeah.
I think it's more like what you said, that it predicts them, detects them. I mean, that's even, I think Mangold called it a time compass.
Okay.
In interviews. So yeah, I don't think it generated the fissure. I think that Voller had to have the almost right calculations to get there and know where it was going, where the plane had to be. I don't think that the dial was generating the fissure.
So in a way, this is the only Indiana Jones MacGuffin that doesn't have power in of itself. Because the Sankara stones have power. The Ark obviously has power. The Holy Grail as well. Has power. Mm-hmm. The Crystal Skull has eye-burning knowledge powers. Knowledge was their treasure. But like the Dial of Destiny, technically no in that sense. It's just the only unpowered item in the Indiana Jones mythos, which actually I think is very interesting for the story itself, because it grounds it in a way that like all the other ones aren't, even though we do have time travel, but it's still somehow not magical. And I think they make a whole point right in the whole movie of being like, this isn't magic, it's mathematics.
Right. I was going to say exactly that. I liked Faller and his view of the whole thing.
Which, but let's all pat ourselves on the back. I think when we were speculating a couple episodes ago about how they're going to bring Nazis back into the story, everyone was right on speculating that it was going to be Operation Paperclip, and it's going to be NASA, and that was great. An expected reveal, but welcome nonetheless.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did we think of Mads Mikkelsen as Jürgen? And now I start with you. What do you think of him as the villain?
I thought he was great. I've always loved him, and I had high expectations for the villain, and they were fulfilled. I mean, he was like so calm, cool, and collected all the time. Like, he never raised his voice. He was really convincing. And I loved the whole twist about it's a Nazi who wants to kill Hitler, because Hitler is not perfect, which obviously... should be recognized, you know, but it was a nice twist to it that I was like, I'm gonna murder him because he started the movement, but he's kind of an idiot, so I'm gonna do everything right. I mean, it was cool, it was unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Alex.
Yeah, I really liked Voller. I thought that he was almost a combination of like Belloc and Donovan. Belloc is Indiana Jones, but like the dark side. They're smart in the same ways. Donovan was someone who was not an archaeologist at all and needed other people to kind of do the work for him. I like that Voller was a smart guy, but he was a physicist and not a historian. Mm-hmm. And he did need help along the way, but he also thought that his mathematics were the end all be all. He's like, I conquered space, now I will conquer time. But because he wasn't a student of history, he messed everything up. Like, I love Indy pointing that out to him right as they're flying towards the eye of the storm. And he is realizing that Indy is right. And it's too late.
Continental drift.
Yeah. And he didn't want to accept it because he's so convinced that his mathematics is infallible that it's not till that last second that it's like, oh, crap, I screwed up.
Yep.
Yeah, he was dope. The one thing, maybe one of you guys can delucidate this for me, because maybe I just missed something, but it's, and I call him Billy Boyd, I don't know why. He's not Billy Boyd, but his henchman, he's always a bad guy. He was also a bad guy in Logan.
What's his Boyd name? Holbrook.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's why I call him Billy Boyd, because he starts with Boyd. very different people. I apologize to Lord of the Rings fans everywhere. I know he's not Pippin, but Boyd Holbrook and Gigantor. Why I didn't really understand why both of them were on Team Jurgen.
Think I do.
Okay, let's fucking go.
I think Hawk, the big guy, I don't know what nationality he was, but boy, like, Glaber was very clearly a like good old Southern boy. I assume he is from Alabama, mm-hmm. and he was just a Nazi. Like,
okay.
I think he was an American Nazi.
Okay, so that's straightforward. No, not a lot of digging.
You could see, like, I know he was trying to learn German at the beginning. The uniform, you know, like,
I think he was
like super excited to wear the uniform.
Yeah, I think he was a Nazi enthusiast, and I was like, little and close to home.
a student of Nazism, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, great. Okay,
and not a great point. I totally forgot he had the Learn German book at the start.
Yeah.
So, one of those things that I actually caught the second time, I was just like, there's some. But yeah, I thought I had missed something. I'm sorry, because I'm like, they're American. I don't know. Whatever, being American, right. I guess, doesn't mean anything in regards to that nowadays, anyway. So the bad guys were good, I guess. We liked them there. And they were vicious this time around. And that's something that I was very, like, blown away a little bit, mm-hmm. especially, like, in the opening and before that first chase scene when they find Helena and Indy, like, at the university, and they put down the secretary, and it was like, oh, crap. This movie's not messing around, and then they kill the dean or whatever the hell he was. I was just like, this is pretty vicious for an indie movie. How do you guys feel about all the gratuitous murder of innocent bystanders in the film?
I actually did not like it. it was something that I would say I would change if I could. 'Cause indie movies are always violent, but this made me feel bad about it constantly, because just innocent bystanders don't tend to get caught up in these adventures. So the two teachers, the cab driver, and then Ronaldo and his whole
crew. The cab driver, we don't know.
The CIA agent said that they killed three civilians, that dude had the gun like hidden behind his back. That cab driver's dead.
It was like, take care of him. Yeah, he died.
Then Ronaldo and the whole boat crew, like,
oh,
I just,
Banderas.
That was just, it made me just sad.
Nani, how did you feel about all the?
It was a little intense, and it wasn't really necessary for the story either. So you didn't really need it. I mean, kick all that Nazi ass you want, but the poor secretary and the teachers and the cab driver just minding his own business And poor Antonio Banderas, just, you know, trying to find treasure.
No wonder he wasn't at the premiere. I was just like, why isn't he here? I was like, oh, no, I get it now. Okay.
Yeah, very murdered. I mean, and there's a lot of fighting throughout these films, but I mean, a lot of the violence kind of happens behind the scenes. Like, you know, mm-hmm. it's happening, but you don't necessarily have to see it, which sometimes is a little bit more creative than, you know, just easily shooting somebody. So, I don't know. It was weird to see it in these films. And then Harrison Ford revisited his the fugitive days as well. They had to add in the whole murder.
I didn't kill my wife.
Yeah. So I don't know. It was a little bit gratuitous, and which is fine in other films because he doesn't love a little bit of gratuitous violence, but it didn't necessarily fit with Indiana.
I mean, it's interesting. I'm not saying that we needed so much murder, but I do think that it helps establish the stakes, right? Because if mm-hmm. you know, we don't off the secretary, we just like, oh well, I think like the movie starts without like, oh, these guys aren't that bad. The minute you kill a nice lady that's just checking in on Indy, they mean business. And they had to kill Antonio and his crew because they needed that boat. They're not gonna, you know. So that one I think I get.
I think I would have felt better, quote unquote, about it if Klaber, who did most of the violence, if he had a worse death at the end. That was something I actually really like Voller's death, even though it wasn't crazy and supernatural the way many of them are. But, you know, Tote is like the worst villain in Raiders, and his face melts. So I would not have minded if something worse happened to Klaber, because he was the really violent one. He was the American Nazi. Even if he was just one of the people that got, like, super impaled by the Romans, that would have been better than just, like, the plane crash, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that would have been cool, but I don't know if that would have pushed the movie into R rating territory, which, you know, it wouldn't be unheard of for indie films to keep the violence going.
One of the pilots got impaled.
That is true.
I'm just like, swap that dude out for Klaber, and that would have felt a little better, I think.
Do you think, though, now that we're talking about the villains' deaths, do you feel that we got what we needed from an indie film in terms of, like, the gore from the death of the villain? Because we do see Mads Mikkelsen, right, and we do see him burnt. It's pretty gory, but I wouldn't put it in the same category of gore as face melting or even Cate Blanchett eye exploding or anything from what we've seen before. What did you guys think of that death? Alex.
I liked it just because I liked seeing him know how spectacularly he failed. A lot of the villains don't get that moment of just like, I really messed up. Yeah. They open the arc and your head explodes. Like, Belloc didn't have a lot of time to just regret everything he had done.
Process it, yeah.
Yeah. But seeing Voller, like, sit down and, put his head in his hands and be like, man.
It was very Arrested Development. It's like, I've made a huge mistake. Nani, how did you feel, though?
Yeah, please turn around. I remember for a second thinking that you know, it wasn't kind of supernatural enough, but the theme of this movie, it wasn't as supernatural as the other ones. So I think if they would have done that supernatural kind of end to him, it would have felt out of place. I did feel satisfied to see, like, his body just, like, all crumpled up there at the end, like, yep, I totally failed. But it felt like it was a trope that was missing, but I didn't really either, you know.
True, which I guess it comes back down to, like, how we watch the movie and, like, how our expectations get in the way of our enjoyment. It's just like, if we just want that and we don't get it, then it's just like, does that actually mean that the movie was bad just because we didn't get a trope? And the answer is no. We just kind of was one of those things that we want. But I do think that they could have like filmed something gory where, like, you see him burning inside the plane or something. you get some aspect of that. But I don't want to talk about the third act too much just yet. We see a lot of familiar faces, obviously, and one of those that we definitely see in the trailer, and I was very surprised to see how much screen time actually they got in the movie, was Sala. And, you know, always nice to see Sala back in the movies. Even though, like, there's lots of things that we can talk about in terms of, like, whitewashing and having John Rhys-Davies portray this character, and that's, you know, definitely a valid conversation to be had. We'll have that at some other point, because I don't think we're going to talk about a lot of other things right now, but definitely something that we do keep in mind when we see those things. But seeing Sala again was very interesting, especially with how they framed it. Our friend Brandon from Talking Bay 94 had said something interesting about, like, how they appreciated how they brought Sala back, because of, like, Brandon's background and obviously then Sala's character's background, and having been brought into the States because of the war and having to escape that country. I thought was very interesting, especially with that context. So how did you guys feel with Sala being back in the movie, what their role was, and the extent of that role? Alex?
At first, I didn't like it, because I was just like, wait, why is he here? Oh, wait, he's a cab driver? But then when we got to his apartment and he explained everything, and it's like, oh, and he's got his family here and he seems happy, I was like, okay, it made sense.
I
At first, it just felt completely out of nowhere. But I liked it in the end.
And Nani, what did you think?
Yeah, I had kind of the same reaction. It's like, how this is really random. Like, yeah. Did they just put him in here just to put him in here? Is that like
non sequitur?
It felt kind of like Lando in Rise of Skywalker, just like, oh, he's here.
Hi. But I really like the interaction with the family and everything, which was really important in that first film. Like, just to kind of ground Indy into like seeing somebody with his family that's like happy and solid. And the comments about, you know, they understand what it's like to be Egyptian but also American, they know their history and all these things. So I thought they were very cool interactions. So, and it's good for Indy, especially because we see him in this such a depressed point in his life where he feels completely alone, to at least have this friend that's been with him forever. It's good to know that he wasn't completely
which I think is kind of this movie does a lot of things right, and I really, really appreciate it. I think it's definitely like a great indie movie to end, well, allegedly end the movie in, because it does a lot of things right and it brings things kind of full circle in that sense. And Salah really kind of exemplifies that, because, you know, we've seen Salah since Raiders, Simon Crusade, not to see him here in a completely different context and to kind of help pad in the storyline, right? Because we see from the beginning that he's already has had Salah as a friend in the States, close to him for a long time, because he's been living there. And the fact that he wants to stay in the past, when he says, like, who am I going to come back for? And it's just like, it's the ending, you know, it's very poignant in that sense. Like, look at all these people that you have here care and like love you and then are part of your life already, that you're just like, I think it's the whole indie trope, right? The thing that it's the treasure has always been there. You just look past it. You just have to like get your head out of your ass and be able to see that treasure's right there.
Sometimes a punch in the face helps.
Sometimes a punch in the face helps. Sometimes both physically and metaphorically, I guess. And we get both. We get both in this movie. Salah was great. And he gave us one of the best line deliveries of all time with Give Him Hell, Indiana Jones. Is something that I will always appreciate. It's one of my favorite Indiana Jones moments, even though I will say I didn't like how it was intercut with the little comedic bit of Indy almost getting run over by a car. Somebody said, God damn it, man. That was such a good moment to just like cut into the plane just flying off and with the map and everything. But I get what they did, why they did it, because he's not Indy yet and he's getting his bearings straight. Speaking of another returning character, Mutt Williams, he is in the movie in some capacity. He's in the post-credit scenes. No, I'm kidding. Actually, that was hilarious because I was watching a video on one of those Screen Crush Easter egg videos, and all of a sudden at the end, he's like, and then in the post-credit scenes, Helena Shaw and Mutt Williams. I'm like, wait, what? I'm like, did I miss something? And then it's obviously trolling us, but it's still funny. But when we leave the prologue, we see like the camera pan through Indy's apartment, and we see the flag with like Mutt's picture in military regalia. So at that moment, I just say, okay, theory confirmed. Let's all pat ourselves on the back again on that one. Mutt's dead. And which I think, one, good job, because, you know, not my favorite character in the films, but I think they did it in a poignant way to not only just fit in historically with what's happening like in the film, but also gave Harrison one of the best scenes that I think he's ever acted. Like, let's not say his whole career, because it's been an expansive career, but definitely an indie film. Like that scene with Helena and him on the boat when he's talking about Mutt
and he chokes up.
I'm like, that's Harrison going 1,000% on indie. So, and now I start with you. What do you think of Mutt's death and like his inclusion in the film and what it meant for Harrison/Indy's character?
Yeah, that was intense. I cried like a little bitch. But it was so emotional, because one of the good things, and we've talked about this before about these films, is that there's so much strength in these relationships and they're done so well. And we were speculating like what had happened to his family, because we know that he's like in this alone, like kind of depressed place when we first meet him in the film, and that we know that it's with Helena that he's running around, it's not with Marion or Mutt. So we had talked about the fact that maybe they were dead. I think that was you, because that was really depressing. And I think I remember saying that I think you said, Alex, that you would rather that she be dead than they be divorced, because that'd be so depressing, like, after everything that they've been through. And then when they show at the beginning, like, the divorce papers and everything, I was like,
no. I was like, oh, yeah. Like, the thing, it was hilarious, because when I see, like, the flag, which obviously what the flag means, you know, that's what they give you at a funeral. And I'm just like, okay, one win. And all of a sudden we see the, and I mean that in the best way possible, which I don't know how that can be the best way possible, whatever. But then we see the separation. That felt like a punch in the, I felt like they punched me in the gut. Because that was brutal, seeing the separation papers. That
was brutal. I was like, oh, no. They punched us with both. One of them said, and they're getting divorced. It's just, like, the worst that it could have been. But, yeah, so we get these snippets. We know what's going on. But we don't get the full story until that scene on the boat. And it was so well acted. It was really emotional. Mm. And I thought Helena was really good as well. I wasn't expecting to like her as much from the trailers, honestly. I don't know why, and I really, really enjoyed her character.
Because you hate women, right? You hate women.
Of course, that's exactly what it is. Uh-huh.
It's just Disney being woke.
God. Fuck. But it was way more emotional than I was expecting it to be. I didn't expect to get so choked up. Like, it was really, really impactful. It was a very beautiful moment, and Harrison acted the hell out of it.
Alex, what do you think?
I agree. I was very glad that they didn't just ignore Mutt and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. That was my bigger fear, I think, that they would be like, let's pretend that didn't happen. Right. I'm glad that, like, that movie counts. I was also, like, you know, in the lead up to the film, people are like, oh, I hope Sala's in it. I hope Marion's in it. I hope Short Round is in it. No one was really clamoring to have Mutt return. So I think that they really used his character in the most emotionally impactful way.
Yeah.
And honestly, all the stuff on the boat, not only that scene, but the whole boat sequence is probably, those like three or four scenes are probably my favorite moments of the film.
It's really, really good. Really good. Because one of my favorite parts of that sequence is definitely the use of the snake bit, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's one of the things that I dislike the most in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. It's like when they throw the snake at him, it's like, just call it a rope. And I'm like, okay, like, this is ridiculous. Like, we know Andy's afraid of snakes, but can we? I don't know. It was used in a kind of hokey way.
Right.
But I didn't really appreciate it. But I like how they reinvented it for this movie and be like, okay, he's afraid of snakes. We're not going to do the snake thing because we always do it. But how about eels? And we don't even have to call them snakes. You know what they look like? And everyone in the audience knows that they look like snake. And Harrison's like, what? Perfect and perfect delivery. So I think it was used to good effect. And then they contribute to the plot in an interesting way. Because then
and the eels were stuck. Kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
They were. Yeah. It was. That whole sequence when they come out of the bones of the Roman or whatever the hell he was, like, awesome. And it looked amazing. Like, obviously, there's some scenes that you can tell that it's not his face, but on the whole, it does look really good.
My friend and I were discussing all of the indie tropes in the lead up to Five, and we were like, what's going to be the creepy crawly this time around? Because we just couldn't think of anything beyond rats, or we just could not think of what would be next. And then the second it was clear it was going to be eels, I was like, of course, just go underwater. Like, but, it's so obvious.
But but at least to me, like, it really took me by surprise that I didn't figure that part out, because we see them in the trailer. In the trailer, we do see the eels, but then no one put together eels are water snakes. I mean, well, there's water, you know what I mean. but they do two creepy crawlies, because then we do get
they do bugs again for a third time.
They do bugs, and I know these are not real bugs this time, but they do a really good job, ILM, because those look really creepy, and it freaked me out. I didn't like that scene, but in a good way. It's just like it made me uncomfortable in the worst way possible, which is what they probably wanted from that. But the boat scene also gave us the graphic host, which I think was also a really cool extra MacGuffin, like a like a sub MacGuffin to the dial. So what did you guys think of that sequence of, like, having Helena, like, apparently give the bad guys, like, the good translation, when she's actually giving them, like, false translation, and Indy's just, like, distraught, being like, what are you doing? And doing finger pointing. What did we think of that sequence? And you know what? And how did we like the graphicos as a whole? Alex,
I love that scene. I really enjoyed her giving some false information, but the dynamite was what I really loved. That provided some much needed, maybe not much needed because Ronaldo had just been shot, but some extra tension of like, are they going to get it lit? The way she was able to get the cigarette from Voller, and then they're trying to light it behind her back. I really loved that. I found myself leaning in to see what was going to happen next.
Yeah. And it was like so seamless by her because Indy was like pissed that she's like giving them all this information and she's right. just playing Voller. And you can see how excited Voller is. Like, he's not a student of history, but you can see he's having fun with the treasure hunting part of it, like trying to figure it out. It's like, oh, I got this. I'm figuring it out. I'm so smart. No, you're getting tricked. So it was really fun. And I did like later on when they actually light it on fire and the wax melts and you can actually find the graphicos inside. And I love this kind of stuff.
It's so good.
Like, when you see it, that's when you start thinking, oh, I could have used a little bit more of this kind of the code breaking and everything. But at the same time, when they do it, it is excellently done. So it's like, oh, I didn't realize I was missing this, but this was good. So.
Yeah. I think the only, and it's not a pet peeve, it's just, I think one area where I think the movie could have like improved a little bit was, obviously, every indie movie introduces new sub-characters, right? Like we have Katanga, we have like all the different people that are showing up in the different films. So there's really not a lot of time for character development for all of them. And Antonio Banderas' character was one of those people. And they got off, so we don't really see much more of them. But obviously, his death is impactful to Indy. And I think one of the best acted parts for Harrison was that part when Helena celebrating right after they're leaving and the boat explodes and she's like, oh, we're getting away. And then Indy's just like, they just murdered my friends. And I'm just like, oh, crap. Oh, I felt that, Harrison. Good job. Good job, Harrison. Give that man an Oscar. But I felt like that was kind of cut short a little bit. I would have liked to have seen more of Indy because he feels bad, right? Because he's at that age where, like they say in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, where life starts taking away more things than it gives you. And even more so now. And I feel like maybe there could have been like a more extended scene of that, of like Harrison being like, oh, I'm just losing everybody in my life, blah, 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 blah. Because, and then I feel like that would have given Antonio's character's loss a little more weight instead of being kind of like, okay, I like murdered my friends. And then let's just move on to the next adventure. So that's it. It's a small bit. I still think like it did the right thing because I think on the whole, the movie establishes all the characters well and develops them where they need to be developed. But we've been speaking a lot about Helena, but we haven't actually spoken directly about her. Played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, she's like the new sidekick. He always needs a sidekick in all the movies, and this is the new one. His goddaughter. What did you guys feel about her? I felt that she was a worthy successor to Marion. I think she's like number two in my indie book. But what did you guys feel, Alex?
I think that's probably fair. I liked her. I didn't like her as much as Marion, but I did like that from the start, she was like this antagonistic ally. Yeah. Like she was actively working against him.
He was kind of like Belloc, if you think about it.
Right.
He does dress like Belloc.
I think that that's fair. There were a lot of references to Indy's past within her. I think she's basically who he was in Temple of Doom, seeking fortune and glory. She has Teddy, who she met basically like Short Round, and Indy met. So I think that she was supposed to be someone closer to Belloc, and then over the course of the film becomes more like Indy. So I liked her for the most part, but the butting heads bit was probably my favorite part of their relationship.
Nanny.
Yeah, it's good because you don't have this psychic who's like in awe of our main character. It's somebody who challenges him and kind of brings him back to who he was, not just like, because he had fully embraced like his professor personality and kind of let go of the adventurous side of himself. And then she was too much into the adventure and for all the bad reasons, because she says a bunch of times that she's just in it for the cash. And even though she is a student of history and denies that part of herself because, and he points it out, like somebody who's in it just for the cash doesn't memorize her father's books, like word for word.
Which I love that scene, by the way. We'll get to it, but.
So she was the character I wasn't expecting to like as much as I did. Again, I think it's almost impossible to beat Marion. You just can't do it. But she was a worthy successor, I would say.
And something I liked about her, especially in contrast to Mutt, is that obviously Mutt challenges Indy, and so does Helena. But I feel like, at least in King Crystal Skull, Mutt does it in a disparaging way, where they're always poking fun of Indy's age. And they do that here, but I feel like here it's, you know, more, there's, it's more tasteful in a way. Like, she's not like making fun of him because he's old, where like, you know, Mutt's always like, what are you, like 80? He's like, ah, come on, man.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel as forced. I feel like that relationship with him, Harrison Ford, and Mutt, like in Crystal Skull, it felt a little bit forced sometimes, and like the jokes were kind of, I don't know, too in your face. I don't know. And this relationship just felt more natural and more believable.
I did like Teddy asking if he went to school with the Wright brothers.
That was funny. That was good. I think it makes more sense that a very young person do that joke, because a young person...
He wasn't trying to be mean. He was genuinely curious.
Like, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. As opposed to Mutt just being purposefully a jerk to Indy. Helena was great. And that scene, I think, for me was very poignant. And I caught it like the first time, but it really hit home the second time I watched the movie, was when they're talking about the dial and everything. And all of a sudden, Indy just asks her, like, oh, why would you go after the thing that drove your father crazy? And then she asked him, like, oh, wouldn't you? And I was just like, oh, crap, Last Crusade. Yeah. And like, your movie, you're doing the right things. I know it's a very small moment, but did you guys pick up on it when it happened, and what did you think of it, Alex?
Yeah, I think that this movie really did a good job at calling back to the previous films without being super fan servicey about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what I took away from that moment. Was I was like, yep, Indy would go after the thing, even though it didn't drive Henry Sr. crazy the way it drove Basil, but if it had, I think Indy would have.
Yeah.
Nanny.
Yeah, I thought it at the moment, and I turned to Husbando. I was like, oh, he did do that. So it was a good moment. So I was so smiles.
And calling back to like the original movies, there is obviously, everyone talks about the aging, especially like with the prologue, but there's actually two the aging scenes in the movie. And there's obviously the classic de-aging that everyone's talking about in the prologue that we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But then there's like the second scene where like they actually de-age Harrison, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull Indy, which obviously it's easier to de-age because it's kind of closer to where Harrison is now. But that also like was pretty cool, because then they dress him up kind of like how he was dressed up in Crystal Skull. So we kind of have like all the eras of Indy like within the one movie. So I think it does that. Like you were saying, Alex, it's like it's fan service in a way that doesn't distract from the movie.
Not like in your face,
Not in your face. But speaking of fan service, I will ask you a question that you asked me, which I failed to answer. Did you catch any Star Wars Easter eggs in? And if you did, and you're gonna do a video, you can leave some surprises for that. But were there any things that you saw of Star Wars Easter eggs within the movie?
Not really. The only thing I noticed was a sound effect as the plane comes out of the fissure, and it was the failing hyperdrive. Yeah. But that sound is just a failing plane engine, so it's kind of like this circular. I don't really count that specifically.
And it's been used in Indy before as well,
right?
And correct me if I'm wrong. There is a Wilhelm scream, but it's not the original Wilhelm scream.
It seems sounded like altered.
Yeah, it sounds, I don't know if it's like a new version of it or they tweaked the audio for it, but it did not sound like the classic Wilhelm.
It sounded enough like it that I was like, that's the Wilhelm, but I think they just changed it a little bit to have some fun.
I agree. Speaking now of Wilhelm screams and all traditional indie things, there isn't more traditional indie than the prologue, because the prologue is classic young indie. And one of the things that happened during the beginning of the movie that I was both excited and then swiftly disappointed by, and I want to know your guys' opinion on this, is the transition. We were talking last time.
Yeah, the logo.
We were talking about Temple of Doom.
They're gonna do this and Skull, and
we were doing. We were talking about like, is there gonna be what's gonna be the transition? We have the Gopher Mound. We have the mountain in Raiders. We have like all these things, and here all of a sudden it starts with the Disney castle, and I'm like, okay, well, that means we're not gonna get the Paramount logo, but all of a sudden we got the Paramount logo.
The Paramount logo, yeah.
So I'm just like, okay, well, here we go. Here we go. We're going to get our transition.
Then it doesn't happen.
And then it doesn't happen. And then we get the Lucasfilm logo. And that does transition to like the square of like some box.
Like a lock, I think.
Or a lock. And I'm just like, that sucked.
That's what people get. Like, I didn't even catch that. And people have been correcting me in my comments constantly. And I'm like, that barely counts. It's just a rectangle. Come on. Like,
it does not count.
It doesn't even have the the arch to it, like, come on.
How did, and this is a stupid, nerdy nitpick to get hung up on, but it's fun nonetheless.
And I thought about it.
Because because the minute I saw the Paramount logo, I'm like, let's go, transition time, baby. Alex, how did you feel about the lack of a Paramount logo transition?
Basically, exactly that. I mean, I had the roller coaster. I was like, Disney, here we go. It's going to transition to a castle. And then it went to excitement of like, oh, they actually did the Paramount logo. Yeah. Like, okay, cool. And then it was like, oh, it's the Lucasfilm logo. And then I'm like, well, I wonder what it's going to transition into. And then it was, so I was looking for it and I missed it. So that means it was not effective. And so I was just like, oh, we're not doing that.
I missed it the first time because precisely because I got distracted by not having the Paramount logo transition. Mm-hmm. I was like, what the fuck? But second time I was like, okay, let's see if it actually, there is a transition. And Lucasfilm rectangle. I was like,
In my opinion, it didn't happen. And I very quickly, I laughed and we just moved on. Like I forgot about it. Didn't care.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think this was a Disney hubris thing. I think Disney for this movie was just like, okay, this isn't a Star Wars movie, so we can put our logos in the front, goddammit. And they were like, we're putting that castle because it's 100th anniversary of Disney, whatever, whatever. We're putting the castle in. And I think that's kind of what ruined the sequence of everything, because I think if Lucasfilm and Mangold had their way, they would have put Lucasfilm, Paramount, and then obviously transition, which I think that's how it happens in Crystal Skull. So I think this was a Disney thing that kind of ruined.
I don't know why they just don't do Disney, Lucasfilm, Paramount, or do Disney last. Like they were at a castle.
Transitioning. Would have used the castle.
Yeah,
castle would have actually been awesome.
Maybe they thought that was too obvious. Maybe they're like, we can't do castle to castle. What are we, map people here?
A rectangle.
Yeah, let's just do Lucasfilm to lock box. Fans are gonna love that one. But it's fine. Listen to the track from the movie. But at least as a font nerd, I was very happy when the title card comes up and it's in the style of the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is beautiful. Like, this is perfect.
I love that. Mm-hmm.
So now that we have all this nerd font thing and logo thing out of the way, the prologue, which is a pretty long prologue. I don't know if it's as long as Last Crusade's prologue, but it was substantial. One of the most exciting parts of the movie, I think, like, universally, I think everyone loves it. We have the de-aged Harrison Ford, which I think looks pretty damn good. I have my qualms with it, and we'll get to that. But, Alex, what did you think of de-aged Harrison 1 and 2, the prologue itself?
I'll start with the prologue itself. Really liked it. Thought it was an awesome start, like with him in the noose, and then the bomb happens and goes off, and then the noose is pulling. Like, it was all very pulpy and one problem after another problem after another problem. So I liked the structure of it a lot. I thought the action sequences were fun. The de-aging, I agree, like, it's the best it's ever looked, but I still, you can't like get it out of your head. You're just constantly staring at it.
I have a theory about that, and I want to see what you think about it. Nani, what do you think about the prologue?
Yeah, the prologue was super fun. I mean, running around in a train and, you know, kicking Nazi ass, like, it's great. Like, there was so much fun in that entire sequence. It just didn't stop. It was so much action, and you're just, like, hooked from the beginning. It's Indy has such a good way of starting films. Like, every time you get through that prologue, it's like, yeah, that's how movies should start. Just, like, from the beginning, just catches you right away. The de-aging, I think it is some of the best we've seen, but it's always a problem when they start speaking. Mm-hmm. Like when they're solid and not moving, it works really well. But as soon as you try to make like the facial expressions and the mouth, you can't see for what
but
it
I don't,
is.
But I don't think it was because, sorry to cut you off, I don't think it was because of
the voice as well. Yes. Because you expect him to sound younger, and then it's like this disconnect of what he sounds like now, which obviously your voice changes. And to see like the young version as soon as he speaks, like, ooh, that's not what he's supposed to sound like.
Yep.
So both that and the mouth, but it's still some of the best de-aging we've seen, I think. And it didn't really take me out of the scene. So in that sense, I would say that it's successful, but it's still, you still, like you were saying, Alex, like you can't not stare at it. Like, you know, it's there. So
no, I believe you. I think that sequence is perfect. Like the news stuff was great, but like for me, like what really was the creme de la creme of that scene was the whole train sequence. It's really like the inside of the train, not so much the outside, like when they're like on the roof of the train, because we've seen that a million times. Not that it wasn't good, but we've seen it. I like the sequence inside with him, like having to, you know, lock all the Nazis and like sit with the tray to pretend that they're not seeing him. Like all the classic indie fun hijinks of like trying to like get through to like get to the object was really, really fun. But the de-aging, I thought the de-aging was like incredible. Like I'm not gonna, I feel like that was ILM flexing, being like, look at all the different things we can do with this de-aging, because different light settings, like because they were like with that whole flashlight. And changing where the points are, because usually when they do the aging, it's like a flat light source, so it's just like easier for the software to do it. But here it's like, nope, look at us, we are the best VFX company in the world. And I think it was absolute perfection. The only thing was exactly what you said, Nani. For me, what took me out of it was the voice, which I was surprised by, because I thought they would do, and I didn't sit through the credits to see if they actually used the re-speecher.
I was about to ask if you knew.
I was surprised that they would just use old Harrison voice, because when he starts talking, I'm like, whoa, why did we get grumpy? Why did we get grumpy Harrison all of a sudden? But I got over it really fast, though. Like after like in the scene for a bit, I feel like you ease back into it, because it's still Harrison, you know? So it's still Harrison's voice and Harrison's face. So after a while, you're like, okay, it's fine. Good, but because the same thing happened to me in Rogue One when I was watching the CG Tarkin, which people are up in arms about how horrible it looked. But I disagree. I think CG Tarkin looks perfect.
It looks good until he starts talking.
But then when he talks, it's not his voice. And I'm just like, well, it's not him. And because he doesn't sound like Guy Henry. So it was kind of, but that's worse in that sense, because he keeps talking like Guy Henry and not like, oh my God, I forgot his name. Help me out. That's Grandma Tarkin's actor. Peter Cushing.
Yeah. I was like, Peter something.
He was friends with Christopher Lee. Anyway, CG Harrison, perfection, which took me a while to figure. So we'll see when the movie comes out on Disney Plus.
We'll sit through. I don't think I consider it perfection, unfortunately. And I got the same. It was also the voice, and I kind of do suspect that they used the re-speecher because it reminded me of Luke and Grogu in Book of Boba Fett, where the voice just sounded flat sometimes, where I was like, shouldn't he be screaming? Or I can't remember the lines, but it was something on the roof, and he was talking
to
Basil.
Oh, you
want to
stay here? Something like that?
Something that it just felt like there wasn't any
emotion behind the voice.
It just sounded like someone reading a line without, like, they weren't screaming it on a train, and it reminded me of Luke talking to Grogu being like, is that all you've got? And it was like, that sounds like it was supposed to be a playful, like, come on kid, like, you can do a little more, but it just came across very just like flat.
But then that to me raises more questions, because then it's just like, if you're going to use a re-speecher, why won't you just commit and just go full young Harrison? Because it's still a grumpy Harrison. Even though to Harrison's credit, he did not sound grumpy. He did sound like chipper, young, you know, spunky Raiders Harrison. So good job on the acting there to portray young enthusiasm. But the voice is still like, you know, like I don't know. That's the only thing that I felt like was a little strange about it. But the other thing that I think they did really well was with the whole body language, because, and I always compare this with the Irishman. I don't know if you guys have seen the Irishman, but in that movie they have Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Joe Pesci de-aged. And they, when they're not moving, they look like they're young counterparts. But all of a sudden, when they start running or doing something, they look like 80-year-old men running. And it's just like an 80-year-old, 20-year-old, you know, type of thing. Especially there's this one hilarious scene. If you haven't seen it, please look it on YouTube. It's Robert De Niro. He's supposed to be kicking this guy to a bloody pulp in a sidewalk. And, you know, if it's a young person, you see someone like going to town. But here it's just like, you know, an old man's got arthritis trying to kick somebody. And it's just hilarious because it takes you out of the scene completely. But I think that's one of the things that ILM did extremely well with this de-aging. It looks like a young Harrison, a young person moving. So yeah. I don't know if that's because it wasn't actually Harrison doing the stuff and they just like plucked a face on there, or I don't know, they did make Harrison take a boot camp to move like a young man. I don't know.
The shot that you're immediately making me think of is when Basil accidentally shoots him and he just kind of like recoils. And I was like, that felt like young Indy. That felt like when Marion burns him in the Well of Souls and he's like, Jesus, like that's exactly how Indy should move when he gets shot.
Perfect. Like I loved it. It's so good. I don't know if it was too long of a sequence, but I think it was exact. Oh, one thing that I felt was, I don't know if it took me out of the moment or I didn't agree with it, but when Valor gets smacked in the face by a giant metal thing to kind of end the sequence, I'm like, I know this is Indiana Jones.
He should have died.
And you know, there's, you know, died. I know Indy survives falling off an airplane on a raft. He survived a nuclear blast on a fridge, but dude got hit in the face.
At least give him a metal scar.
Right. Like, he should have a big ass dent on his face, like some James Bond villain or something. But is it just me, or did you guys also feel like he should have been dead?
I had that thought.
Yeah, I was like, he just got decapitated.
Which actually, I think it's the strength of the film, actually. It's like going back to that visceral kinetic energy that the original three had, because like the original three feel like when you're getting hit, that you got hit. As opposed to Crystal Skull, which as much as I like it, still feels fake, right? A little fights feel like you're pulling punches, or it's like all CG, so there's not that, you know, that physicality that the originals had. And this one, I feel like you felt all the hits that everyone got. Let's go finally to the third act. So we knew there was going to be time travel. We knew that there was going to be some Back to the Future hijinks, even though these technically weren't Back to the Future hijinks. But we knew there were going to be hijinks in the past. And I didn't know if we were actually going to go to Nazi Germany and Indy was going to encounter his younger self. And, you know, I didn't know what to expect. So the moment that they go through the fissure in time and we're in the Battle of Syracuse, I was kind of blown away, because it's not at all what I was expecting, even though the movie does its gosh darn darndest to set it up. Alex, what do you feel when we traverse through time into the Battle of Syracuse? And how did that fit for your expectations of the movie?
I really dug the third act. I can see it being divisive. I think time travel's always like kind of, I was anxious about it building up to the movie, and within the movie itself, I was like, I hope I like the time travel stuff. And I did. I thought they were actually pretty restrained. I feel like they told us what they were going to do the whole movie, from the beginning lesson to the marionette to the propellers on the Phoenix. And
the watch.
And Indy kind of having that moment of seeing Valor put that same watch on. And so I love Back to the Future, but I'm glad that they followed Terminator rules of time travel, of like, whatever happened, you cannot change it.
Happened. Yeah.
And the original Terminator, people, Genesis, not that stuff. That's different. Nani, how did you feel about the Battle of Syracuse?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I was like you, Alex, as well. I was like, it's so easy to screw up time travel, and it could ruin the movie if they tried to, I don't know, if they went to Back to the Future on it, I think it could have possibly ruin the film. And I hated when they used time travel also as an excuse to like maybe fix the past, you know, and which I feel like they could have if they were trying to forget about Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, mm-hmm. which they didn't. And I'm so glad that they didn't. Mm-hmm. Because it's still part of the series. Like it happened. It's part of it. So I was really worried about what they were going to do. And then as soon as they go through the time rift, like Wally's the one that picked up on it right away. It's like, are you seeing what I'm seeing? They have sails. It's Roman triremes, which I loved. I love the angle of them going like ancient Rome and all that stuff like throughout the film, because they usually do, you know, the Christian relics, which is cool as well. And I did love at the beginning that they do the lance and it's fake. Yeah. Which I actually really enjoyed. So this like ancient Roman everything angle, I really, really enjoyed. And the battle looked really awesome. Like it could have looked really bad as well, but it held up. Like the lance is getting thrown, then thinking that the plane is a dragon. The whole thing, I thought the sequence was really cool. And I loved that end. You know, he looks like when he's saying that he needs to stay and he's being all indie about it, and the music swells and he puts on the hat and I'm being such a badass because I'm staying behind because I'm going to witness history. And then he just gets punched in the face. And I was like, it was such a relief. It was like, thank you for doing that.
Yeah. Cause it was dragging a little bit. I was like, at that point, I was like, okay, cause that's the thing. We obviously expect all the, you know, magic crap to happen at the end. And so the minute that we go, I did have a different visceral reaction from you guys, because when we go into the that past, I'm like, what's happening? Where? What? I'm like, what is this?
I really liked it.
I was about to yell at Kathy, like, Kathy, what you do? It's like, James, my boy. What is this? The internet's going to hate you. But it's like, I was just like, oh, we're going that much in the past. Like, how, like, we need another hour of movie then. It's like, to be able to then, we need to get back to the future. 85 miles per hour. Like, this is a whole nother movie that we just started. So, like, I was worried. But then when that whole scene with Archimedes starts happening, and he starts talking about being in the past, and he has nobody. And it's like, okay, the theme. It's about the theming. Yeah. And, like, so the theme of the whole five films. I'm like, here. And he, like, always wanting to protect the past. And now he is the past in a world that's moved on from him. Now he feels more. I was just like, this chef's kiss.
It works.
Good job. It works perfectly, right? Especially not just with the themes of like all five of the movies, but also with this whole movie as itself, right? Because it's all setting itself up for that. And I like that it's the closed loop. Like everything that happened in the movie was already happening since the beginning. And the ending couldn't have happened if the beginning didn't happen, and the beginning couldn't have happened if the past didn't happen. So it's kind of like the closeness of it, I thought was like really clever. I did think that kind of the end was dragging when him and Helen are just like arguing over the thing. I was like, oh my God, just go home.
Thank you for punching him. Thank you.
But I did appreciate the punching, even though it was a little jarring. But I did think that it works to set up the final scene, which I think kind of, my heart almost exploded watching that final scene, because I wasn't, the only reason I was expecting the thing to happen that happened was, unfortunately, because I was at the premiere and I saw that Karen Allen was there. And it's like, Karen Allen, I was like, Karen Allen's not going to be at this thing if she's not in this movie. And then Brandon goes up to me, he's like, oh no, they put her in the billing in the last poster, so she's going to be in it. And I was like, oh, thanks for ruining it, man. So all of a sudden, we have the Karen Allen scene, which was such a beautiful scene. It was incredible.
The second she walked in the room, boom, tear.
Oh yeah, same. I was like,
and she looked amazing. Like I feel like she looked like way better than they made her look in Crystal Skull. Like in Crystal Skull, I don't know, she looked a little funky there to me. I feel like here in Dial of Destiny, she looked amazing. So the minute she walks in, I'm just like, oh, here we go. Let the waterworks. So, Alex, how did you feel about, we're past the Battle of Syracuse, now we're back in 1969, and Karen Allen, Marion Ravenwood, walks in. What was that scene like for you?
Well, I'll jump back to Syracuse for a second, just because I like that Indy is just kind of not allowing himself to see all the things he does have, and he's like, I want to I have a chance now to be a part of history. And it's like, dude, they just landed on the moon. And he's like, you are living through history, and you've been through World War II. And if we want to count the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles as canon, you've met so many people. And he acts like he's just kind of not able to move past his grief and see he is living in history. He does have so many people who care about him. Helena is literally arguing with Archimedes about like wanting Indy in her life. And he's just like, nobody wants me. And it's like, dude, wake up. And then to have him wake up and see Sala there and Helena and Marion. I loved the Marion scene in the end.
Nani, how did you feel?
Yeah, my heart. As soon as you saw her walk in, I really wasn't expecting her to show up in this film. And it just brought everything full circle to me because the whole movie, I was still so upset. Every time I remembered that they were getting divorced, I would get like, I would feel upset about it. And then to see her and for them to recreate that scene from Raiders or where doesn't it hurt? As soon as he asked it, I was like, oh, they're doing this. My heart cannot take it. It was perfect. It was a perfect way to end that film. It really was.
But I also like that, obviously, even though it's a very sentimental scene, it also has a little bit of humor in it, because like in the beginning, when he gets the divorce paper, he puts like the little magnet on her picture, and then here, like when she's there putting things in the fridge, it's just like in the background, just moving the magnet off. It's just like, okay, that's such a little moment that like not a lot of people might pick up on, but it's still so indie and hilarious. And that kind of helps lighten up that scene. It's great, especially with when Sala and Helena are just like, oh, let's go get some ice cream. And Teddy's just like, she already bought some. Ice cream. And she's like, let's go, my dude. Let's go.
And hearing Sala sing as he's walking away.
Yes. Oh my God. That was so good. And that's one of those scenes that like got a lot of like cheers when people like start hearing Sala singing in the background. I was just like, yeah, it's good. I think it was a great way to just end the movie, especially with like that exterior shot of everybody just, you know, being happy and going to get ice cream, and then just pans
hat,
and we see the hat because he hung his hat, but not quite, because then he just takes it off and the movie ends. What did we think about that ending and what it might mean for Indy or the franchise? Alex, what did you think?
I think it's done. I think they've said enough. Harrison has said enough to be like, this is the final adventure. Indiana Jones is like done cinematically. I think him snatching the hat back off the clothesline is like Indiana Jones is back, as they said, but more like emotionally, spiritually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe he has more adventures, but like we don't need to see them. Like he and Marion, they better stay together this time.
Oh, yeah, like that's
please. Stop fooling around, kids. Fooling around, you crazy kids. Yeah. Settle down. Some, well, you can't anymore, but whatever. Nani, what do you think about the ending?
Yeah, I think they just added that in because, well, one, it looked cool, because it did, because it's the hat, come on.
It's very George Lucas, too, with like the PowerPoint transition, you know.
So I think they're done. But I think it's what Alex said, that he's, because Marion asks him, you know, are you back?
Are you back?
Are you actually back? And I think it is that, you know, that he finally is able to deal with his grief and look at the people around him and appreciate the life that he still has. So I think that's what that meant. I don't think they're doing any more films.
I don't think they're doing any more films with Harrison Ford. Right. But we don't know what the... I think Disney is a corporation. I think Disney Plus needs content. Because this is the first time apparently like in streaming history where like subscriber counts have been going down, or it's just a Disney Plus thing, or it's like a global thing. So you know, I think these companies want to push more content to push more subscribers to their platforms, and I think that nothing's off the table. I just don't know in what capacity, right? I don't know if they're gonna reboot the Indie Chronicles, are they gonna like do a reboot of the series, which I hope to God they don't. Okay. But I don't see them not doing
walking
something
away from the franchise completely.
With this franchise. I just don't know what the angle could be, because how do you make Indiana Jones series without Indiana Jones.
Well, James Mangold in a podcast on Happy Sad Confused mentioned the Ravenwood series that was rumored. And he said, like, I saw some of the stuff they were putting together for that, but it sounds like that's not moving forward. Which I don't think Abner Ravenwood could support his own series. We know we've got the video game on the way by Bethesda.
But it's Xbox exclusive, so I am not a fan.
It'll be on PC too.
But... I don't have a PC. Oh. I have a PlayStation, goddammit. I bought a PlayStation 5 for a reason.
But yeah, like, I would be okay, honestly, if they were just like, Indiana Jones is a franchise I love, but also one that I'm like, I don't need a movie every year. It's just one that I like revisiting.
I don't think it can sustain it. I mean, let's be honest. I think from what we've seen with this box office for the film, how it's doing so far, I don't think we're alone in saying that we don't need more movies, because most people are just like, okay, I thought we were done. We're okay. And I don't know if it's a thing of, like, it just doesn't resonate in the same way anymore, because people were saying, like, well, this is the dad movie. But then so was Top Gun Maverick, and that broke the box office. But then again, that's a more palatable, modern thing for audiences to go see. So, like, I'm not sure. Like, I love Indy, and as much as I don't want it to keep going, I also don't want it to stop, if that makes sense. Because there's something fun about a new indie movie. It's just like maybe every 20 years or something. Yeah.
I don't think that. I'm skeptical that that would happen. I don't know what they would do in 20 years. In 2043, maybe they just do something in the spirit of Indiana Jones and have a different character. But, like, I don't know that I need it to be in the indie universe.
Yeah.
We need another archaeologist. Nani, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you in spirit there, Goose. Like, you don't really want it to end. It's
give him hell, Indiana Jones. You want that.
It's good to have this anticipation of wanting to go to the movies and watch something that's adding to a story that we already love. But, no, I'm okay with it being done.
This is good. Great. I mean, this is a good closing point for the episode. I mean, it seems like we were all very enthusiastic
really
about
that
the movie.
This film is better than Crystal Skull. Yeah. So we kind of ended it on a higher note than what we already had. So that kind of brings everything a little bit more full circle. So I was happy that this is.
Yes. And yeah, I'm very happy that it's my number 3. Yeah. Even though I know that's controversial, some people really like Temple of Doom. I personally don't, so I'm very happy that I have 3 Indiana Jones movies that I really like, one that I think is fun, and then another one that I just don't watch. So I think that's good. Alex, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I want to bring up one character that I just haven't seen a lot of people talk about, and it's, I believe his name is Luigi in the credits. He is the pilot that's on Teddy's plane that he steals. Right. I just love that dude who wakes up.
He's the Glupschitto of this movie.
Yeah, he's my new indie Glupschitto, because he just wakes up and is like, okay, I'm 2,000 years in the past. And he's just, I mean, I assume he saves all their lives.
That's a good
point.
Gets
them out of there.
He's the one that flies up.
He should have been in the apartment at the end. And Indy would have been like, who the hell are you? Because he would have been unconscious when all that happened. But this is Luigi, and he's our best friend now.
That would have been awesome.
That is some shit, and he deserves to be here.
That blew my mind. I like that. That's a good
no one's gonna believe that man.
No, he's like, can you believe it? It's Indiana Jones. I'm sorry for my terrible Italian accent, but oh, that's really good. Holy shit, I never even thought about that, because he was hilarious with Teddy, but I didn't think about his life after.
I
just traveled through time. What is this? Maybe he was drunk at the time, so he thinks it was all just a drunk dream, but holy shit. Nani, any closing thoughts?
I love that. No, that was perfect.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you? What do you have coming up in the future for your channel?
I'm on Star Wars Explained, mostly talk about Star Wars. Talked a lot about Indiana Jones the past month, but we're going back to Star Wars. Molly and I are doing a Rebels rewatch right now, getting ready for Ahsoka, so we'll be doing some Rebels content, but things are kind of slow until Ahsoka comes out, so
yeah,
We're just talking about Star Wars and whatever's coming out.
Great. Obviously, yeah, make sure to check them out if you haven't. It's amazing content over there. So thank you again for joining us and theoretically concluding, unless Harrison has some surprises for us, our Indiana Jones series has been definitely a lot of fun and definitely like a nice change of pace to stop talking about Star Wars and have a lot of fun with another franchise that we're all very enthusiastic and passionate about. So thank you so much, and I hope everyone obviously has had a great time listening to all of our silly thoughts about everyone's favorite archaeologist. But with that, Nani, why don't you sign us off?
Thanks again, Alex, for joining us. This was so much fun. I hope everybody goes to the theater and watches it. Don't worry about the naysayers. Just enjoy it. It's a great summer film. Just have some fun with it. So we are Triad of the Force. Until next time, may the Force be with you.